Zoom.us. Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lorai. Coming up today, we're going to talk about who is the most powerful lobbyist in Tallahassee. That's one of the topics that's going to come up today as we listen back to Florida this week from this past Friday night. We'll also be talking with a local ACLU official about some of the events that are going on that the ACLU is sponsoring. But first, one listener comment about last Friday's Radioactivity program. Much of that show was focused on discussing guns, as we've been doing for the last couple of weeks. Here's what one listener had to say following Friday's show.
Pretty hilarious the way you dealt with those Alex Jones nuts that called at the end of your show. Yeah, I mean, you know there's a secret slave colony of pedophile victimized children on Mars, and demons are coming into the children through the television and MK Ultra and Obama. So, you know, I hope that you don't, actually you handled it really funny. I you know, you might want to have a whole hour where you invite Alex Jones people to call in and tell you all of their truths.
Well, there's a listener comment that came in after last Friday's program. Let's listen to Florida This Week, which is a television program on PBS on WEDU-TV on Friday nights. And it's a discussion of state and local politics. And as we listen back to this program from last Friday, you can email your comments into the studio here at dj@wmnf.org. Coming up next, a big divide in Tallahassee over what to do about guns. Meet the lobbyist from the NRA who has a winning record in the state capitol. The bill to ban texting while driving in Florida is in trouble. And the effort to end autonomy on the USF campuses moves ahead in the legislature. Political insights next on Florida This Week.
WEDU Studios, this is Florida This Week. And now, moderator Rob Lorai.
Welcome back. This week our panelists are Chris Ingram is a political consultant and a Republican. Mitch Perry is an enterprise reporter for FloridaPolitics.com. Brian Willis is an attorney and a Democrat. And Claire McNeil is a reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. Well, it's great to have you here. Thank you for coming. Well, the future of gun legislation in Tallahassee is up in the air. In the wake of the Parkland massacre, there has been pressure on the legislature to do something. The biggest differences are in the House, where Republicans have a solid majority. House Bill 7101 is in serious trouble, as members of both parties keep finding reasons to vote against it. For instance, pro-gun hardline Republicans oppose the three-day waiting period in the bill to buy a gun and raise the purchase age to 21. Some Democrats will vote no because the bill doesn't go far enough by outlawing weapons like the AR-15-style rifle used at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. A new Quinnipiac poll shows 62% of Florida voters support a nationwide ban on such assault weapons. Governor Rick Scott opposes arming teachers, but House Speaker Richard Corcoran is a leading backer of school marshals, of arming trained teachers, and arming staffers. Some Parkland parents and students call arming school personnel reckless. And a new Quinnipiac poll says 56% of Florida voters oppose that idea. The legislature's Black Caucus opposes HB 7101, in part out of concern that arming school personnel could encourage racial profiling. So, a very unusual coalition of pro-NRA Republicans, liberal anti-NRA Democrats, Scott loyalists, and African Americans could defeat the gun bill.
Chris, is it likely that Tallahassee is going to pass some sort of gun legislation? We've only got a week left in the session.
Given how late it is, I find it unlikely. I think in a typical year, we would find it highly unlikely. Given the events of the last week or so, a greater chance, but still not very likely this is going to see the light of day. I think that a lot of Republicans, myself included, who happens to be an NRA member, but could support some what's referred to many times as common sense gun legislation, like an age restriction on those under 21, 3-day waiting period, more intensive background checks. I'm okay with those kinds of things. I think when you start calling for bans on certain types of weapons that are currently lawful, that is when you're going to start to lose support. But some of this common sense solutions are certainly well within the means of being accepted by a lot of people, including a lot of NRA members.
There's no ban on semi-automatic weapons in this, and that's why a lot of the parents and the kids from Parkland are upset. So, but this is, as the bills go, is much more moderate than it could be. Right. It's not a very liberal bill.
Yeah, I think if you had the ban on AR-15s and the like, it would definitely not see the light of day and would never pass. But look, I think that the gut reaction when you're the victim or the family of a victim of something like this is to call for, you know, much more intensive bans and whatnot. That is an emotional gut reaction. I'm thankful every day that I've never had to experience that with one of my children in school, but it's something that's real that we do all think about. But I think that as a society, we need to think greater than just what, you know, a ban is going to do. We need to look more intensively at you know, how our schools are secure. We need to look at societally how we treat one another, what our kids are exposed to. This is a much more complicated problem than a bumper sticker knee-jerk reaction to a terrible tragedy to say, well, let's just ban all these guns. That's not going to solve the problem. The next person will come in with something that hasn't been banned, mm-hmm. and the problem hasn't been solved. We just put a Band-Aid on it.
Brian, do you think there's going to be a gun bill passed in the next 7 days in the legislature?
It certainly doesn't look like it. I mean, you've got a shocking coalition that's lining up in opposition to this, and I think it really striking that one of the iconic images of this tragedy is an image from Tallahassee. It's the Parkland students with that despair on their face when they sort of were confronted with the reality of what life is like in Tallahassee and the Tallahassee legislature. And it's an image that sticks with me and I think is going to stick with a lot of Floridians on Election Day. As for the logic of a ban, I mean, I understand the idea to not act emotionally when there's some sort of one-off event, but this is a repetitive over and over again where people are going in with these assault-style weapons and committing this crime. And we really are an outlier, a dramatic outlier, compared to the rest of the world in terms of these violent mass shootings with these weapons. And we're also an outlier on the lack of gun regulation. So,
and I would, to your point, would just only comment that if we were to ban AR-15s, which can have legally a 30-clip magazine, it's a semi-automatic weapon, I would actually argue that that weapon is more clunky to do ill will toward others than if the same person were to carry three Glocks with a 10 magazine.
But the fact remains, there's no ban being considered in Tallahassee.
Any weapon used with harm intended toward innocent people is an assault weapon.
Okay, the fact is this. I'm not a prognosticator, but I'm going to disagree with you guys. I think they're going to come up with some bill. It's something going to be nobody's going to be happy with, per se. But Governor Scott went throughout the whole state this week touting his $500 million package. Richard Corcoran is going on Breitbart and Fox News boasting about his Marshall Program. These high-level Republicans have a lot on the line here. And even though I know it's only 16 days since Parkland, it's still a big deal, okay? And I think that there's a demand to do something. You're talking about where the math is on the votes. There's only a few, I don't think the Republicans, there's only a few that I know of right now who are not going to vote for this in the House because of the provisions you mentioned, Chris, in terms of what the NRA doesn't like about raising the age and also the 3-day waiting period. The Democrats are not happy that there's got funding for arming teachers.
Right.
But they're the minority, right? So I think that they're going to come up with something, and we'll see. The Senate is a really big what the Senate comes up with tomorrow, because on Monday the House is going to deal with their product, and I think they're going to pass something.
Okay, now Claire, the governor and the Speaker of the House are divided because the governor doesn't think we should arm teachers. The House Speaker Richard Corcoran thinks that we should arm teachers and arm some staff people at our public schools. So that conflict alone spells doom, I would think, for this legislation.
I think it's definitely one of the major tension points in this bill, and I think that there have been some headaches around the messaging of arming teachers. It's kind of become the shorthand for what the bill is moving toward, but if you look at it, I mean, the reality is that it would be a very select group of 132 hours of training, background checks, mental health screenings, firearm safety. So there's saying arming teachers, I think, conjures a certain image when the when Corcoran and the others are saying, well, no, it's not quite that. But you get, you're getting parents from Parkland saying, we don't need more guns in schools. This is 37,000 more guns in schools. That's just going to add to chaos. And then you have people like, I think the African-American, the Black Caucus, saying that this is going to lead to racial profiling in schools. And so it's become a really emotional flashpoint.
Do you think they're serious about arming teachers? Because one of the things you talked about, 132 hours of training, they're going to give teachers a $500 stipend. Is that enough to cover the training? And, you know, and does that show that maybe they're not really serious about arming teachers?
I think if you're an overworked teacher and you have $500 incentive to do this program, of 132 hours of training that will essentially make you part of the sheriff's office, I don't know that that's enough to get teachers to raise their hands and sign up, and then also make themselves part of the news story too, and put the, I mean, with all of this attention on the school resource officer who did or didn't go in the building, I don't know that people want to be that person.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point. There was somebody with a gun at this school, and it still happened. I mean, I'm of the generation that went to school when we had school resource officers. My high school had somebody with a gun at that school, and there's a difference between one person who's a police officer who's lived that for their life, that's had far more than 132 hours of training, and then putting 10 guns in a school. And what happens when there's a fight in the hallway? What happens when there's the first person that dies because there's an accident with this gun?
Why is it that the governor is against arming teachers? What are the politics of that? What does the governor know that Richard Corcoran doesn't
know? Well, I would say, because look at what's happening here. Claire is right. This has become, Wilton Simpson, I saw a complaint about this today. This has become the biggest issue almost about this piece of legislation, which is not the dominant part of it. It's the dominant news part of it, but it's more about, you know, hardening schools and mental health resources for that, right? But this has become a hot button issue, a big time, and a very controversial one. And Scott, I think, he's going against the NRA, right, who wants this, actually. So it is kind of gutsy on his part. But also, he is running, we all think, for U.S. Senate. So, and this is not a popular issue.
Does that mean that the governor's read the polls and he realizes this is not a popular issue in the state of Florida?
Definitely reading the polls. You can count on that. He's probably paying for his own polls. And look, the end of the day, I think most people think it's just this is not the solution to the problem. Is it an idea worth talking about? Yes. Is it worth implementing? No. And I think, but we talked about earlier, the fact that they're only offering a $500 incentive for a teacher to do this program with 132 hours required to get the license or whatever that you need to be a teacher in a school with a gun. I'm not real good at math, but that ain't a lot of money per hour, and I don't see the incentive.
I think talking about Rick Scott is that the bill is probably going to come to him with funding for teachers, and then the question is going to be, what does he do? And he's not going to, I don't think he's going to veto at this point. Again, he wants this bill. He wants a bill to say he's doing something about school safety.
Mitch thinks it's going to pass. I'm thinking it's not going to pass. I think that once we get through this week, there's so much division. There's conservatives and liberals that don't like this bill. So to whose advantage is it if a bill is not passed? If we look toward the fall elections, who is going to be able to make hay out of this if there's no gun bill coming out of the legislature?
I think Bill Nelson, and you saw him there. You saw him at Tallahassee today going around lobbying and putting himself into this story, very smart, very strategically. Not really something that I remember the U.S. Senator coming to Tallahassee to lobby very frequently. And so I think he's somebody who sees this via Governor Scott is something that's going to give him an edge.
Chris, advantage in November, if it doesn't pass, who gets the advantage?
You know, I'd have to say I think just generally Democrats right now. But, you know, a lot can happen between now and November. I think by not passing a bill, and I think they will not, I think the legislature will not, and I think if they did, I'd be surprised if the governor signed it, if it included things like anything beyond a three-day waiting period and raising the age to 21, if it had any kind of ban, which it doesn't, but that's not going to occur. But this teacher proposal, I think, that is just going to continue to drive the controversy. If a bill were passed and the governor signed it, we will then be talking about this 6 months from now. And I think that the powers that be in the Republican Party in Tallahassee are really looking at this like, let's just not give this any legs and let this die out peacefully over the course of the next week.
Claire, who gets the advantage if they don't pass a gun bill this week?
I don't know that I can read those tea leaves. I don't know that I am seeing how it'll play
not
out.
Not going to go out on a limb for us. Mitch, what do you think? I mean, I know you think it's going to pass, but if it doesn't pass.
NRA Republicans will be happy it doesn't pass, and they'll do well in their primaries. But I think that every incumbent, it's not going to be good for them, because they're going to be showing that they couldn't do something when people demand some type of legislative solution to this. Not a solution, ultimately, but an answer.
All right, we're going to find out next week. Well, one of the reasons the NRA is so successful is the influence of their lobbyist in Tallahassee, Marion Hammer. Hammer has played a powerful role in the state capitol for going on four decades. The 78-year-old has had 30 bills passed in the last 20 years, many of which she herself has written. Among her bills, Stand Your Ground and Concealed Carry. A major New Yorker profile out this week says that state employees, legislators, and the governor all defer to her. According to the article, she gives orders and they follow them. Hammer demands complete compliance. A legislator who votes with her less than 100% of the time is not good enough. The NRA has 300,000 members in Florida, and Hammer has tens of millions of dollars at her disposal to shape the outcome of elections. So, Brian, late in the week, a South Florida legislator, a Democrat, says he's going to hold a one-man investigation into Marion Hammer's power to see if she has too much influence over staffers, legislators, and the governor.
Good for him. It's needed. I mean, this story, it was a shocking read in the New Yorker to look at this, because it illustrates the complete disconnect between what the average person thinks goes on in terms of making a law and what's actually happening in Tallahassee and what the students of Parkland were confronted with when they went up there and tried to lobby. I mean, you have somebody who's making $310,000 a year, living full-time in Tallahassee. You have Parkland, which is 500 miles away, and these students are driving 8-10 hours to try and be heard. I mean, I think it illustrates why you need to move the legislator and get it closer to people.
Move the state capital.
Move the state capital, put it to Lakeland. I mean, there's statistical studies out there that show that states that have their legislator further away have more corruption. And there's just such a disconnect that you have this woman who sits there, and you have Republicans quoted in this story saying, if you don't vote with her 95% of the time, you're her enemy.
All right. Marion Hammer, Chris, what do you think?
I know Marion. Talked to her many times.
She's very good at what she does.
And she is feared in Tallahassee if you get on her bad side. And also, it's add that I find it hard to disagree with pretty much anything that you said. I mean, it's true.
The lesson. Is that New Yorker article said she was?
Absolutely.
All right.
She's probably, outside of anyone elected or appointed at a high level, she's probably the most powerful person in Tallahassee.
Mitch, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this is an article that shows the, I hate the cliche, but the sausage being made here. And there's a reason why Florida is the gunshine state. And next to Texas, we're the most pro-gun state in the country. And it's because of the power she has. Although I say it's the power that these legislators give her, right? Because we know that lobbyists do have a lot of impact on maybe just writing bills. Dennis Baxby admits in this article that she writes bills, and Matt Gaetz basically admitted it as well. But they give her that power, too. And a lot of Republicans in Florida, they like guns, though. So, I mean, she gets a lot of credit, and deservedly, for her power that she has. But I think that the state, it goes beyond Marion Hammer about why we're such a gun-friendly state.
All right, so Claire, isn't this what special interests should do? Get a powerful lobbyist, get a big mailing list, get a lot of money behind you, and put pressure on legislators. Isn't that what every special interest should do?
I think that she is very savvy about the way that she goes about it, using one of the most striking things to me about the story was the use of really emotionally charged language. So it seems to be going beyond just, you know, shaking hands and making deals to tapping into a really emotional thread, sending out mass emails, not just saying that somebody disagreed with legislation, but calling them traitors, betrayal. It's casting a vote against a certain way of life. And I think that is kind of what helps the supercharge the grassroots movement in a way that's different from other special interests.
Yeah, and it reminded me, I mean, some of the quotes from her emails reminded me of what you've probably all seen on Facebook, these sort of fake news articles and things that are just riling people up. When you're calling a Republican legislator that votes with you 95% of the time a traitor because they didn't align with you one time, and you're blasting that out to 2 million Floridians, it's this whole nother network that maybe we're not even aware is happening, but it has a deep influence on the state. And I think term limits are part of the problem, right? I mean, you talk about legislator and legislative power. These people come, they go. Marion's still there.
Lobbyists get more power as we have term-limited legislators.
I love Brian. He doesn't just talk about the problem. He talks about the solution. We were moving to Tallahassee. We got rid of term limits today.
I'm ready to go.
I just wanted to comment, though, to the comment before about you know, the special interests and their power and, you know, kind of the red meat that Marion tees up for the NRA faithful. The Democrats do this too. I won't name the person, but there's a candidate for state legislature here in Tampa Bay Area whom I like as a person. I think would be a fine legislator, even though is a Democrat. Sent out an email announcing his candidacy a few weeks ago, and I didn't like it because it was Democrat red meat, and it was offensive to me as someone who likes this individual who's running, and so, you know, it goes on both sides. Marion, maybe does she take it to a little bit further extent than the norm? Yes, but it's been very effective for her. I mean, again, she's one of those powerful people in Tallahassee.
She sure is. Well, a bill to ban texting while driving was passed this week by the State House, but it's facing opposition in the Senate, and it's not clear it will make it to the governor's desk. Already, 43 other states ban texting while driving. Currently, Florida law says texting by non-commercial drivers is a secondary offense. That means officers must see another violation, like speeding, before they can cite a driver for texting. The House bill, HB 33, would make texting while driving a primary offense. Over in the Senate, Senator Rob Bradley is a chief opponent of the bill. He says he's concerned about giving extra power to the police and about privacy rights because the police may have to inspect cell phones to prove that someone was texting. So, Mitch, Bradley is the new Jack Latvala. He's the chair of the Appropriations Committee. Why is he opposed to this ban
on
texting?
I guess he's woke now because he's all sensitive about racial profiling. Look, this is Florida. The House passes 112-2 the other day, okay? So it's got pretty widespread support in the House. So you've got one man who's going to block it because of what he says is the problem with it. Look, racial profiling is absolutely very sensitive.
But he's a Republican. Why does he take on the issue of racial profiling?
Well, I think it's a convenient thing for him not to want to pass this legislation. Now, I don't really know why he's talking about privacy rights. If you remember Ellen Bogdanoff years ago in Fort Lauderdale, she also stopped this. But look, there's a reason. Again, I'm talking about lobbyists. Why these aren't things? We're very much a minority in terms of, this is a state that only has secondary texting while driving laws. This would only make us primary. This is still a pretty weak tee, actually. Yeah. You know, states like New York and California have a hands-free where you can't even pick up the receiver. So, but about, again, the racial profiling aspect, which is very legitimate. Sean Shaw, a Democrat here in Tampa, he says he's good with the bill now because there's some provisions there that will list every person who's, you know, by ethnicity who they bring in.
There'll be some tracking.
Yeah,
those people that are arrested. Yeah.
So I think that most of the Black Caucus, who definitely raised objections early on, I think are okay with this right now. So Rob Bradley's the reason, you know, because he believes in this, we should kind of do it.
And I think the whole notion, man, I'm not an attorney, maybe Brian, you can answer it, or we can get some other attorney on here at some point to say whether or not there's any merit to his claim, because I just don't buy that a police officer would have to actually see the content of the cell phone. If he were before a judge as an officer of the court himself and said, this person was on their phone, I watched them do it, I don't think the judge is going to care whether, well, did you visually inspect to see whether or not he had sent a text? Because this is about more than just texting. It's about using your phone for any purpose, other than calling 911.
GPS, though, that you can't get busted for that. That's part of the law that says if you're looking at that to get directions, and you said that you were doing that for that, you don't get busted for that in this bill.
Okay.
Maybe you should.
Well, the potential consolidation of USF's three campuses took one more step toward becoming a reality Tuesday when it was voted onto the floor of the Florida House of Representatives with a few changes. According to the USF Oracle, the university would still be combined under one accreditation, but an amendment proposed by Republican State Representative Larry Ahern of Seminole allows for satellite campuses to control their own budgets and their own leadership. While those changes take steps toward allowing more autonomy for the St. Petersburg and Sarasota Manatee campuses, critics of the merger don't consider the amendment to be enough. Some of the representatives expressed concerns about the bill and how quickly it was pushed into the legislature. St. Petersburg State Representative Ben Diamond says he's concerned the legislature is rushing into this before it's had a chance to hear from the communities served by USF.
Claire, you've been covering this. Larry Ahern, and why are, you know, Chris Sprouse and Larry Ahern and some of these other Republicans so gung-ho on doing this? What's their ultimate aim?
Well, the amendment or the consolidation.
The consolidation,
itself.
Yeah.
USF is poised right now to ascend to the top tier of state universities alongside Florida State and the University of Florida to this category called preeminence. When you hit preeminence, you unlock millions and millions of dollars in bonus funding and a new layer of prestige. The way that the current setup is with USF Tampa separately accredited, USF St. Petersburg and Sarasota Manatee, all three being independent, that preeminence designation, the wealth, the honor, wouldn't necessarily trickle down to the branch
campuses. So this guarantees that those satellite campuses would get more money?
The amendment is aimed at doing so. So the consolidation would bring them all under one accreditation umbrella as one USF and kind of make them more equal to all the other state universities. USF is the only system in the state which has irked some lawmakers for a long mm-hmm. time. And theoretically, that is what Representative Sprouls and Ahern and some of the other Pinellas people have said, is that look, we're trying to, rising tide lifts all boats. We're trying to get everybody to benefit from this honor and money.
Okay, that sounds reasonable, but you've got some Democrats like Ben Diamond mm-hmm. that's skeptical. Why is Diamond skeptical of this?
At its core, this has become a huge, huge trust issue that unearths all kinds of old scabs between these schools. So USF St. Pete only became separately accredited in 2006. And that was the result of many decades of tension. The St. Petersburg campus has long had to scrap for resources and attention. And really, I think, fought for its own sense of identity and independence. And so accreditation was the symbol of them ascending in their own way, and to now take that away raises all these old questions of trust
and it goes
power.
Back to, actually, it's funny to have this fight. You know, the reason that there's Hillsborough County and Pinellas County, they used to be one county, so the Hillsborough County government wouldn't pave the roads in St. Petersburg, and so they formed a separate county. So this is a long-standing battle, mm-hmm. but I don't think we've been well served by these small universities. I was looking at the statistics. USF St. Pete's about 5,000 undergraduates, Manatee's about 1,000, USF main campus is 30,000 or more. I also think about the split off from Polytechnic over in Lakeland, and that entity, that university, doesn't seem to be doing well separate from USF. I think they're stronger as a whole.
All right.
I have to agree, as an alum of USF, got my master's degree, I don't think this is going to affect students, and that's what we really ought to be focusing on.
Okay. Well, before we go, what other news story should we be paying attention to? Claire, let's start with you. Your other
sure.
big story.
Well, it's a continuation of the consolidation question, but as you bring all these students to the preeminence metrics, USF wants to raise admissions standards across the system. So they want students with a 4.2 weighted GPA. That's right below what UF, the flagship university in the state, is aiming for. So some lawmakers have raised, I think, legitimate questions about whether an average B student, hardworking student in Pinellas County, can actually attend his or her hometown university, or whether that path will necessarily have to be the state college system.
Okay, Mitch, your other big story.
The politics of guns. This might be the case with Marco Rubio. We all saw him a week ago when he was on that CNN town hall debate and got grilled severely in front of a live audience. Quinnipiac polled a couple days later, and Marco is big time underwater. He's only at 37% and even lower with Hispanics. He came up with his own proposal yesterday, his own gun regulations. He talked about in that live hall, that debate, that he would maybe have some bills that he'd be pushing that he could support, but it's nothing about higher capacity magazines in there or assault weapons.
He backed off some of the promises he made on CNN. Chris, your other big story.
Well, I think the developing story is the Tampa mayoral race. I think that we're going to see a lot of heavy hitters, big players in this race, and some new folks, some old folks, and I think it's going to all start to kind of wash out here in the next month or so as to who actually is going to be in this race or not. Been a lot of speculation, and it's going to develop quickly.
Wow, it's so early, too.
Yeah, it's earlier than normal.
All right.
Well, I'm on crane watch for downtown Tampa, especially also downtown St. Pete. There's so much development going on. The Water Street Vinnick project is really going to be breaking ground here soon with a lot more development in downtown Tampa. So I think it's an exciting time for growth in the urban core, and a lot of years, really decades of work have gone into reinvigorating and creating that opportunity.
All right. Well, Brian, thanks a lot. Chris, thank you. Mitch, thank you. Claire, thank you. Thanks for watching Florida This Week. Well, that was Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV. And my guests were Claire McNeil, who's a staff writer at the Tampa Bay Times. Mitch Perry covers politics for FloridaPolitics.com, also the host of a Midpoint program here on WMNF. Brian Willis is a local attorney in Tampa. He's a Democrat. Chris Ingram is a commentator on Bay News 9 and a Republican. So if you want to comment about anything you've heard here for the last 25 minutes, you can email into the studio here. Our address is dj@wmnf.org. Well, the Pinellas County chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union will hold its annual Bill of Rights banquet and 50th birthday celebration tomorrow at Banquet Masters in Clearwater. And we're joined now by historian Ray Arsenault, who's a member of the Pinellas County ACLU chapter. And Ray is also the author of Freedom Riders, 1961 and the struggle for racial justice, and he's going to tell us about the annual Bill of Rights banquet that the ACLU holds. Ray Arsenault, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
So tell us more about tomorrow night's banquet.
Well, this is our 26th annual banquet, and we hold it each spring. It's kind of a gathering point for people interested in civil liberties, and each year we make two awards. One is the Gardner Beckett Civil Liberties Award, named for Gardner Beckett was the longtime head of our legal panel and one of the most prominent civil rights and civil liberties attorneys in Florida. And he died in the mid-1990s, and we named this award for him. And we've had very kind of distinguished awardees, very deserving awardees over the years. And this year in particular, Nadine Smith of Equality Florida will be given the Gardner Beckett Award. Mm-hmm. So we're really pleased about that. When we nominated her and chose her this year, I thought we must have given it to her in the past because she's done such extraordinary things over the years as the executive director and now the CEO of Equality Florida. The other award that we give is named for Irene Miller, who was one-time president of our chapter. Unfortunately, she passed away as well. And we've been giving this award for courageous journalism during the past 15 years or so. And this year, we're giving the award to Mark Puente, who's an investigative reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. And so we're really excited about that as well. And so it's really our big event of each year. But this year in particular, this is the 50th anniversary of our chapter. It goes back to 1968 when Gardner Beckett and others created a small chapter. In those days, the ACLU of Florida as an organization was only 3 years old. It goes back to the mid-50s in Miami, but it was kind of a fledgling group. They formed the state affiliate. Each state has at least one affiliate, but Florida was kind of late to organize. We're now the fourth largest affiliate in the United States, and I think considered widely as one of the very best, if not the best. And we now have I think upwards of 60,000 members in the state, and which has been a great expansion over the last year. Our own chapter here in Pinellas County now has 4,000 members.
Wow.
We're very proud of that. For many years, we had about 1,200, but in the last year, since the 2016 election, we've had a tremendous expansion and a great interest in defending the Bill of Rights, which is, the primary goal of the ACLU going back to its founding.
Well, Ray, why would there be the uptick in membership in the ACLU since the election? Is there a particular issue that's happened that people are concerned about that they've told you about?
Well, I think there are many issues that we're involved in, everything across the board that involves the first 10 amendments to the Constitution and the 14th Amendment. But I think it's a concern really about the very future of American democracy with President Trump in office. That I think we're a nonpartisan organization, but we respond to threats wherever we do constitutionalism and democracy where we find them. And I think there's been a general perception that it's really time to step up. And so we've had thousands of people joining the ACLU because I think they felt that the ACLU is an organization that will not back down, that we have a tremendous record going back to 1920 of defending civil liberties and civil rights and anything associated with the Bill of Rights.
So tomorrow night at the annual dinner at the Bill of Rights banquet of the ACLU of Pinellas County at Banquet Masters in Clearwater, the ACLU national president Susan Herman is coming to give a talk.
Yeah, we're so excited about that. We've never had her at any of our banquets. She's been president, I think, about 8 or 9 years now, and she's been a tremendously effective national president. She works, of course, with Anthony Romero as our executive director, and she's coming down from New York. I think she's going to be doing some other events around the state, but we timed this specifically for our 50th anniversary, so we're really excited. She's, by all indications, a terrific speaker and a wonderful, wonderful civil libertarian, so we're really excited about that. So she's going to give the keynote address. We also have a jazz trio playing tomorrow night from the Al Downing Jazz Society, and so between that and Susan Herman, it's going to be a great, great occasion, I think, and of course our awardees. So we're expecting a nice turnout. Anybody who would like to go can contact Margaret Evans, who's our treasurer, online at mbuu@earthlink.net, mbuu@earthlink.net, and she could take care of you. We can take some last-minute reservations, I'm sure. More the merrier.
Okay, so that's tomorrow night at Banquet Masters in Clearwater, the Pinellas County chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union holding its annual Bill of Rights banquet and 50th birthday celebration, giving an award to Nadine Smith of Equality Florida and Mark Puente of the Tampa Bay Times, and the ACLU National President Susan Herman is going to be there. What time does it start?
6 o'clock. There's a cocktail hour, 6 to 7. We have a very brief election, electing new members to our board for 5 or 10 minutes, and then the dinner, and then we'll have the program with also Howard Simon. An added thing I should have mentioned, Howard Simon, who has been our executive director for the last 20 years, and he's the senior executive director in the nation. He was at Michigan 23 years before, and I think he's coming towards almost to the end of his tenure. We're very sad. We don't know how we'll operate without him, but he always comes and gives a kind of report on civil liberties in Florida. So Howard Simon will be there as well. So it's going to be a wonderful array of speakers and just a great evening all around.
He's always a great speaker. And Ray, I'm not going to ask you. We just were talking on Florida this week about the reconsolidation proposal of the three USF campuses. And there's also this issue of arming school teachers. And I won't ask you about that because you're here in your capacity as a member of the board of directors of the Pinellas chapter of the ACLU. So, but maybe we could get you back and talk about some of these other issues.
Yeah, so we've actually been, I'm the president of the chapter, and we've been co-sponsoring symposia with the League of Women Voters and other groups, Fired Up Pinellas, on the gun issue. We're very, very concerned about that.
Well, you talked about the Bill of Rights. So the Second Amendment is part of the Bill of Rights, and it says a well-regulated militia being necessary to a free state. The people's right to bear arms should not be infringed. How does the ACLU interpret that amendment?
Well, historically, of course, everything has changed legally since the Heller decision about 7 years ago. Prior to that time, I think there were 18 challenges before the Supreme Court over the years, and in every case, they had upheld the interpretation which the ACLU supported, which was that it had nothing to do with individual gun control or individuals with guns. It had everything to do with a well-regulated militia. And we although we have to deal with the reinterpretation, we still maintain that that's the correct interpretation. That, of course, the Heller decision was a 5-4 vote, which could be reversed under perhaps a more progressive Supreme Court. So we're hoping for that. So we support the traditional interpretation of the Second Amendment, but we're still hoping that we can revert to the one that will have obviously will help to curtail this epidemic of gun violence in the United States, which I think we all agree is just a crazy, crazy situation, very, very dangerous.
Ray, do you think the founders intended to arm people so that they could overthrow the government if the government became oppressive?
I don't think so. I mean, the term militia is a bit slippery, and it's open to different interpretations, but certainly the interpretation that the state cannot regulate firearms, I think, is just incorrect, and it's an extremist position. But I think much closer to the truth is the notion that the founding fathers thought that there should be the right to form militias. It didn't mean that you could have AR-15s in your personal arsenal. Of course, they didn't have AR-15s in those days, and they couldn't possibly have anticipated it. So the kind of originalist interpretation of this doesn't make any sense anyway. I mean, whatever the Founding Fathers intended, those things, of course, are always reinterpreted in light of social realities of the day, a kind of legal realism, which I think is essential to a living, breathing constitution. No, I don't think they anticipated anything like what we have now. I think maybe most of them, maybe not all, but most of them would be horrified by what we're dealing with. I think there's a misconception that the population was much more heavily armed in those days. I think a lot of the production of firearms and the possession of them is reached, again, just absurd proportions relative to kind of earlier social convention in American history. I mean, obviously, firearms were dispersed, again, they were dealing with muskets and things much less deadly than these semi-automatic and automatic weapons.
Yeah, I was reading the New York Times report over the weekend, interviews with doctors who had seen the effects of AR-15 rounds hitting a human body, and one of the doctors reported it goes in and makes a small wound, but when it exits, some of the wounds can be a foot wide.
I read that too. It's just horrific. It's just I know our position in the world relative to other societies is we've become so far to the extreme as a gun culture. As one historian put it, we've become a gunfighter nation, and that's much poorer for it, I think, and hope that some reason and sanity will be returned to the policies. But it's the NRA has enormous power, but I think all we have to do is learn to stand up to them. And, it will dissipate. But this is the ACLU is in a little bit of a difficult position because we're so committed to the Bill of Rights, and when the courts reinterpret one of the amendments like this, we obviously have to deal with the reinterpretation, but we don't have to like it or to give up in our efforts to go back to what was the legal traditions of American history. As you may remember, of course, the NRA was a strong supporter of gun control in the 1960s. That's how far we've come. And, of course, it hasn't been that long since assault rifles were banned.
Yeah.
So if politicians can create this mess, they can also hopefully get us out of it as well.
Well, Ray Arsenault, the president of the Pinellas County ACLU chapter, tomorrow night's banquet is at 6 o'clock at Banquet Masters in Clearwater. It's the Pinellas County chapter of the ACLU's annual Bill of Rights banquet. If people want to find out more, you mentioned that email before. And also, could you give the email again and also the phone number for more information?
Yes. The email is MBUU, all caps, MBUU. At earthlink.net, and that's the earthlink.net. That's the email for Margaret Evans, who is our treasurer. I don't have a phone number right now. I'm sorry.
I've got one in front of me. It's
72. I think Margaret is our clearinghouse person, and she'll take good care of you if you'd like to come to the banquet. It's going to be a wonderful occasion. We're very proud of our civil liberties presence in Tampa Bay. There's a very large chapter in Tampa and in Sarasota. So we have three very large chapters, combined membership, I think, of over 12,000. And so there are a lot of people who care deeply about these issues, and we're always looking for volunteers and people to become involved in the many issues that we are involved in, from reproductive freedom and separation of church and state and any number of, things involving in criminal defense and proper sort of due process in the courts and in the jails and the prisons and just so many other issues that we sometimes feel like we're putting multiple fingers in a dike, but we're happy to do it. It's for most of the people involved in ACLU, it's a lifelong commitment that we take very, very, very seriously. So we're really excited to have all the activities that we're going to have tomorrow night.
All right. Well, Ray Arsenault, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming on M&F. And when your new book about Arthur Ashe comes out, we'll bring you back and talk about
August 21st.
Okay. Ray Arsenault, thanks for coming on WMNF.
My pleasure.
All right. Thanks, great to talk to you. Ray is the president of the Pinellas County chapter of the ACLU. Tomorrow night's banquet is at 6 o'clock at Banquet Masters in Clearwater. And here's a phone number for more information. It's 727-347-4266. And Ray is the author of several great books, including Freedom Riders, 1961, and The Struggle for Racial Justice. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're going to open up the phone lines for the last 10 minutes of the show. Frank Knox is our phone producer today. If there's something that you want to comment about, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Our email address, if you want to send in a message that way, send it to dj@wmnf.org. And here's a message from Mike. And Mike says, keep up the good work. Finally, some gun logic for a change. We should handle weapons of war like the military does. So I can't open up this email, but the email apparently is a conversation of James Fallows with somebody in the military. And it's from The Atlantic, so you can look that up online and see what James Fallows has written about how the military itself regulates weapons. I just want to read something real quickly from the New York Times. Really interesting story. I don't know if I find it interesting because it has to do with sex. I'm not normally obsessed with sex, but I find this very interesting. The New York Times just broke this story a few hours ago. The dateline is Bangkok. And let me read the first three or four paragraphs. And there's going to be more on this, I'm sure, later today. A Belarusian escort with close ties to a powerful Russian oligarch said from behind bars in Bangkok today that she had more than 16 hours of audio recordings that could help shed light on Russian meddling in the U.S. elections. The escort, Anastasia Vashakevich, said that she would hand over the recordings if the U.S. granted her asylum. She faces criminal charges and deportation to Belarus after suspicion of working in Thailand without a visa at a sex training seminar in the city of Pattaya. Ms. Vashakevich, who described herself as close to the Russian aluminum tycoon Oleg Deripaska, said that the audio recording she made in August 2016 included discussions she had about the U.S. presidential election with people she declined to identify. Mr. Deripaska, a billionaire with close ties to Russia's president, Vladimir Putin, also has business ties to Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign chairman. Mr. Manafort is under investigation by Robert Mueller, the special counsel looking into the campaign's connection to Russia. Ms. Vashakevich said, "If America gives me protection, I will tell everything I know," she said today. "I'm afraid to go back to Russia. Some strange things can happen." Her assertion could be easy to disregard, writes the Times, if it were not for a 25-minute video investigation posted last month on YouTube by the Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny, which relies heavily on videos and photographs from Ms. Vashakevich. She and nine people from Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus were arrested late last month in Pattaya, a city about 70 miles south of Bangkok, known for its adult entertainment scene. Most of those arrested, including Ms. Vashakevich, 21, also goes by the name Nastya Rybka, are accused of working without a permit. Some are accused of not having a valid Thai visa. I'll stop it at that. But the article is much longer. It just came out in the New York Times this morning. And the headline is, "Audio Recordings Prove Russian Meddling in U.S. Election, Escort Says." Very interesting. If you want a copy of that article, you can email me at rob@wmnf.org, and I'll send you that. And then it'll link to that Russian video, too. Might be interesting. 813-239-9663 is our phone number. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Let's go to Tim, who's in Sarasota. Hi, Tim. You're on WMNF. What would you like to talk about?
That piece of news that you just read is very interesting. I think it falls in with the blackmail perspective with Trump not going through with more sanctions and not mentioning anything about Russia and the meddling. I mean, we all know it's pretty obvious. I mean, even our intelligence agencies went before the Senate, 2 weeks ago? And the Senate asked them, you know, did the president instruct you to do anything? And they said no. I mean, the guy is doing everything he can not to do anything or not to mention that. And then also using distraction techniques as far as blaming Obama for, which is ludicrous, because when Obama left, he led the biggest sanctions package on Russia of any president in the history of our country. So, I mean, it's obvious there's three reasons here why Trump won't do what Congress wanted him to do a month ago when the deadline expired. It's either A, personal interest, he doesn't want to do anything, or it's B, it's, blackmail, or number three, it's preventing a World War III from occurring, nuclear war or whatever. And I think, you know, with you mentioning the escort thing, that could come under play with the blackmail issue, I think.
Well, if this woman does have some sort of audio recordings, and there are native-born English speakers at the one end of the line that she has, I would think that the the House and the Senate committees, the intelligence committees that are investigating possible Russian meddling in the election, I think that they should reach out to this woman and see what she has to see whether or not there's any sort of proof that Russia did meddle.
They do have proof. It's not possible. The FBI and the CIA, they know. They have evidence of it. They know what they did. We don't know everything of the details or the results of their investigation, but, I mean, it's highly probable. It's Russia we're talking about. They constantly try to undermine our democracy. And you know, there should be a huge alert among Americans and politicians, especially on the Republican side, that say, wait a second, Trump's not doing anything. He's not adding more sanctions. He's not doing anything at all. And Russia just constantly keeps thumbing their nose at us with flybys and everything else, helping North Korea. I mean, you know, there's a UN deal there where none of the countries are supposed to be helping North Korea, but Russia's doing it behind our backs. Obviously, we have satellite and can see what's going on. And what did Trump do about that? He did nothing. They're doing oil and coal back and forth with Korea. They have pictures, evidence, satellite, and Trump is not doing anything. That's an alert right there. That's a red flag. And Republicans are not saying anything, ignoring it, not doing anything at all. I call that treason. That's what I do. I call that treason. He's not protecting us. Our infrastructure is being attacked upon. We have a cyber war going on with Russia right now. He won't acknowledge it publicly. He will not. He just ignores it. So, I mean, there's a lot of red flags going on right now, and no one's questioning it, which, you know, that's your American duty, is to question stuff like that, and no one's doing it, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some people have spoken out about it. Our Democratic senator here in Florida has spoken out about it. He said when he was in Sarasota about a year ago.
What Republican?
No, the Democratic U.S. senator.
Right. How come a Republican hasn't?
Well, I think, you know, if Marco Rubio were here, we could ask him. But Bill Nelson, when he was speaking in Sarasota last year, said if these stories are true, it's an act of war. I mean, I know you don't like me being careful, but I'm just saying that you're right. The intelligence officials were there. They testified in Congress.
Either
they said,
believe them or you don't.
They said that Russia meddled in the election. But I'm waiting for more proof. I mean, not that I don't think that they're telling the truth, but I want to see the proof.
You're going to see it with Gates and Manafort.
Yeah. That's why I made the case as I was reading that New York Times article that I think that if the House and Senate Intelligence Committees are interested in getting to the bottom of whether Russia meddled in the election, they ought to get this woman's tapes and bring them to the U.S. and, you know, if there is meddling being discussed, identify who the native English speakers are at the other end of the Russian line and see what they say, and then, make that public.
You got to give him kudos, man. Right at the very day one, when he knew they were coming in close on him, he went right out into the public and brainwashed everyone thinking that it's all fake news.
All right. And Tim, I don't mean to cut you off, but we're out of time. But thank you so much.
Yeah.
All right. I gave you about 6 minutes. Hope that was enough for you to explain. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. We'll play those comments back tomorrow at 11. Stay tuned.